stretched out on her straw mattress and slept. He brought in another verdict of self-defense, so that Olga Alexandrovna was more and more startled to wake up again in her cold cell, to discover the eyes of the Countess raking over her, as if they were raking over the ashes of the crime, always finding there more significance than mere manslaughter. Then the devil's advocate in Olga Alexandrovna's mind found it necessary to order a retrial, and she had to start all over again. So her days passed. The floors of the cells were lined with felt, and as well as a similar lining of felt on the walls, there was, at a distance of 5 inches from the surface of both walls and ceilings, a wire mesh covered with paper, an arrangement intended to prevent the inmates communicating with one another by means of knockings and tappings. So there was perfect silence within this place, except for the muffled footfalls of the wardresses, who were forbidden to speak. Silence, but for their footfalls, and the sound of the metallic slidings of the grills, and the shrill insistence of the bell that rang in the morning to wake you, and the bell that rang in the evening to tell you to lie down, the bell that told you dinner was ready, the bell that ordered you to have your dirty bowls and plates ready for collection, the bell that ordered you to stand by the door ready for the exercise hour, round and round the yard, the Countess turning slowly in her chair to pace you, the bell that said the exercise hour was at an end. Silence, but for these sounds, and that of the ticking of the clock. Snow piled against the outer walls of the House of Correction. Spring came, and the snow melted, but the inmates saw neither the fall nor the vanishing, and neither did the Countess either, for the price she paid for her hypothetical proxy repentance was her own incarceration, trapped as securely in her watchtower by the exercise of her power as its objects were in their cells. This merciless woman nevertheless believed herself to be the embodiment of mercy, which she conceived of as the opposite of justice, for had she not removed her women from the sphere in which justice, which is necessarily merciless, operates, the court, the prison, and placed them in this laboratory for the manufacture of souls? With so much looking, her eyes had grown quite white. How did she sleep? And were her sleeps troubled? No, not troubled, but random and infrequent, for she never liked to close her eyes, although even she, deficient as she was in common humanity, needs must recharge her batteries in the good old human way. But when she snatched a wink, she drew Venetian blinds down on her windows and left lights burning, so her prisoners could not tell if indeed she slept or was only pretending to do so. Because sometimes she would draw the blinds when she was not asleep in order to demonstrate that she could escape from the tyranny of their eyes any time she chose, though they were never free of hers. This was the only area in which she was able to exercise freedom, although she was the inventor and the perpetrator of this wholesale incarceration. The wardresses were also trapped women, for the House of Correction was manned exclusively by women, who lived barrack-style amongst those they policed, and were imprisoned by the terms of their contract just as securely as the murderesses. So all within were jailed, but only the murderesses knew this was the case. The longer that Olga Alexandrovna rehearsed in her mind the circumstances of her husband's death in her ample, and it sometimes seemed posthumous leisure, for in that place she felt as good as dead, the less she felt she was to blame. She went over and over everything, again and again, starting from the beginning. Childhood in the tenement. Her weary mother, stooped with toil, marriage, birth of the son she would never see again. The way her husband repeated with relish old Russian proverbs in praise of wife-beating. How she pawned her wedding ring to buy the food, only to have him rob her of the cash for drink. Blame it on vodka. Blame the priest who married them. Blame the stick that beat her, and the old saws that helped to shape it. But don't blame me. And having exonerated herself, let the judge think what he would, she at last slept easy. The first untroubled night she'd passed in that place. She was a woman of considerable intelligence, which the phrenologist had classified as low peasant cunning. She had quickly learned to mark the passage of the days by making a scratch with her fingernail on the plaster surrounding the bars through which she and the Countess did their reciprocal observing. This was the only area of her cell which could not be seen from outside. Though never, until pressed by circumstances, any great shakes at arithmetic, she'd made considerable strides in simple addition since she'd been here, and the secret inner surface was fairly pockmarked with the scars of empty days when the morning after that good night's sleep she did her sums and discovered her third year in the place was over and the fourth year just begun. Having survived all those who had been in the place when she was shipped there, she now qualified as a long-stay prisoner. She decided the time had come to make herself at home and began to sit up and take notice. Now, according to regulations, the silent wardresses wore hoods when they delivered meals, hoods which concealed all the features of their faces except their eyes, for even the Countess was forced to concede they must be able to see where they were going. But she wanted them to remain anonymous instruments, to exhibit no personal qualities that might obtrude upon the isolation of each inmate. So they never lifted their eyes from the ground, not when they served breakfast or when they served supper or when they unfastened the cages to let the women out for exercise. But their gloved hands were at risk as they slid the trays through the grills. Olga Alexandrovna, who in a former life had followed the profession of a seamstress, possessed fine, slim fingers and besides was of a sociable temperament. Though speech and looking were denied her, still she thought she might be able to touch one of these fellow prisoners, because Olga Alexandrovna, sitting and thinking, thinking and sitting as the clock ticked the days that turned to weeks, to months, to years, had come to the obvious conclusion that the guards were as much the victims of the place as she. That morning, she sat waiting at the grill for breakfast, one eye cocked on the revolving Countess, the other on the clock. And when the minute hand hit the hour, the bell rang and the grill slid open with a metallic rasp, she slipped one lovely hand, for lovely hand it was, into the gap, and clasped the hand in the leather glove that pushed in the tray from the other end. At the touch of Olga Alexandrovna's white fingers, the hand under the black glove quivered. Emboldened, Olga Alexandrovna clasped the leather glove more warmly. With a courage far beyond Olga Alexandrovna's imaginings, the woman in the hood raised her eyes to meet those eyes that Olga Alexandrovna now fixed on her. Then the bell rang, and the grill clanged down, and Olga Alexandrovna lost her breakfast because the tray fell to the floor outside the cell and the porridge spilled. But she did not care about that. Though the light was burning behind the Venetian blinds, the Countess must have nodded off for a moment, for she did not see this mute exchange, although they saw one another clearly. And that was the moment, even before the gate opened and let them all out, as it was bound sooner or later after that touch to do, at that moment Olga Alexandrovna knew whoever it was who might truly sit in judgment on her had elected to dismiss the charge. That evening, after a free if surreptitious exchange of looks as supper was served, Olga Alexandrovna found a note tucked into the hollowed-out centre of her bread roll. She devoured the love words more eagerly than she would have done the bread they replaced, and obtained more nourishment therefrom. There was not a pencil nor pen in the cell, of course, but as it happened, her courses were upon her, and, ingenious stratagem only a woman could execute, she dipped her finger in the flow, wrote a brief answer on the back of the note she had received, and delivered it up to those brown eyes that now she could have identified amongst a thousand pairs of brown eyes, in the immutable privacy of her toilet pail. In her wound's blood, on the secret place inside her cell, she drew a heart. Desire, that electricity transmitted by the charged touch of Olga Alexandrovna and Vera Andreevna, leapt across the great divide between the guards and the guarded. Or it was as if a wild seed took root in the cold soil of the prison and when it bloomed, it scattered seeds around in its turn. The stale air of the House of Correction lifted and stirred, was moved by currents of anticipation, of expectation, that blew the ripened seeds of love from cell to cell. The slow hour's walk around the covered inner courtyard, where the guards kept pace with the inmates, when, for just that single hour, the bars did not divide them, took on something of a bridal, a celebratory quality, as the flowers that sprang from those seeds grew in silence, as flowers do. Contact was effected, first by illicit touch and glance, and then by illicit notes, or, if either guard or inmate turned out to be illiterate, by drawings made in and on all manner of substances. On rags of clothing, if paper was not available, in blood, both menstrual and venous, even in excrement, for none of the juices of the bodies that had been so long denied were alien to them in their extremity. Drawings, as it turned out, crude as graffiti, yet with the effect of clarion calls. And if the guards were all subverted to the inmate's humanity through look, caress, word, image, then so did the inmates wake up to the knowledge that, on either side of their own wedge-shaped cubes of space, lived other women, just as vividly alive as themselves. Silently, surreptitiously, as the unacknowledged autumn changed to winter outside, a warmth and glow suffused the House of Correction, a glow so inappropriate to the season that the Countess herself felt the effects of the palpable change of temperature within, so she would sweat. Yet she could not, no matter how hard she looked, detect a single visible change in the mechanical order she had laid down. And even though she gave up sleeping altogether, and introduced a hysterical randomness into her revolvings, so that she sometimes made herself quite giddy, and sometimes stuck stock still for almost an entire minute by the authority of the clock, she never saw one suspicious thing. She never thought the guards might turn against her. Did she not keep their contracts in a locked iron box in her watch-room? Had she not bought them? Were they not forbidden discourse with the inmates? Did not the forbidden thing itself forbid? Her white eyes were now veined and rimmed with red. As she went round and round, she drummed nervous tattoos on the arm of her chair. The notes, the drawings, the caresses, the glances, all said in various ways, "If only," and "I long." And the clock ticked the time of another lifetime, another place, above the gateway that grew each day larger in their imaginations, until the clock and the gateway that had signified the end of hope now spoke to them of nothing but hope. So it was an army of lovers who finally rose up against the Countess on the morning when the cages opened for the final exercise hour, opened and never closed. At one accord, the guards threw off their hoods, the prisoners came forth, and all turned towards the Countess in one great united look of accusation. She took out the pistol she kept in her pocket and fired off shot after shot that banged but did not reverberate as they ricocheted off the bricks and bars of that echoless chamber. Her firing scored one bull. She stopped the clock, shot the time right out of it, broke the face and stilled the tick forever, so henceforth, when she looked at it, it would remind her only of the time that her time ended, the hour of their deliverance. But that was an accident. She was too stricken with surprise to aim straight. She wounded nobody and was easily disarmed, chattering away with outrage. They locked up her door, took away the key, and threw it into the first snowdrift they encountered when they opened the gate. They left the Countess, secured in her observatory, with nothing to observe any longer but the spectre of her own crime, which came in at once through the open gate to haunt her as she continued to turn round and round in her chair. Kisses, embraces, and the first sight of unseen beloved faces. After the first joy was over, the women formed a plan to make their way to the railhead, since they lacked maps or even compasses, and orient themselves by the railway track. Once they were sure they knew where they were, then they would decide on where they should go, whether, as some of them, even in the first throes of their new love, still wanted to trek back 4,000 or 5,000 miles to the village or the town where their mother still tended children orphaned by the law, no matter what befell after, or to strike off by themselves and found a primitive utopia in the vastness round them where none might find them. Vera Andreevna knew the place Olga Alexandrovna kept in her heart for the small son she'd last seen when he had milk teeth, and kept her peace. They were armed and all clad in good stout greatcoats and felt boots stuffed with straw taken from the guardroom. They had food with them. The white world around them looked newly made, a blank sheet of fresh paper on which they could inscribe whatever future they wished. So, taking bearings by the pale sun, they set off, hand in hand, and soon started to sing for joy. Chapter 4. When darkness came, they found themselves in the shelter of the forest and decided to bivouac in brushwood shelters for fear of losing themselves in the night. Once they were settled down, they noticed a red glow in the sky above the trees, in the direction of the railway. Olga Alexandrovna and Vera Andreevna were chosen by common consent as advance party, and crept forward, concealing themselves amongst what bushes they could find, until from a bluff they saw a remarkable sight. An entire train, disarticulated like a broken toy, the carriages scattered by the explosion that had twisted the tracks, until they resembled knitting got at by kittens. Many of the carriages still blazed with the same fire that had set light to the trees nearest the railway track, although some ineffectual effort seemed to have been made at putting the fire out. And lying among the debris, toppled like giant ninepins, something untoward, something extraordinary. Beings such as Olga Alexandrovna in her childhood once saw in the Tsar's menagerie, in her native St. Petersburg. Elephants. Enough dead elephants to fill a fair-sized graveyard. And then a movement amongst the wreckage showed them that one huge beast was still living and was engaged, even in extremis, in lifting from here to there beams and twisted wheels with its trunk. Then, most strange, the sound of music, of fiddle and tambourine, and Vera Andreevna drew Olga Alexandrovna back behind a tree to let a peculiar procession pass. And pass it did, without the outlaws who policed it spying the women, for which they were grateful. Outlaws, bristling with weapons, outlaws with hostages. A fair girl, crying, and a huge brute, dressed like a peasant, comforting her in a language that was not Russian. And a little man in striped trousers who was shouting out, could the women have understood him, "I demand to see the U.S. Consul!" And there were a couple of primitive wheelless carts, dragged by more outlaws, in which lay blanket-covered mounds, one silent, but one bawling fit to bust, and a little grizzled dark woman, muttering to herself in a language different to the one the others spoke, but which was not Russian either. All most unexpected. And then more outlaws. But it was the motley band who brought up the procession that made the women cross themselves. For these were men of all shapes and sizes, some small as dwarves, some long and lanky as clothes poles, less than a dozen of them, in the ragged remains of what had once been bright clothing, in the strangest styles. Some had huge red noses, others big black rings round their eyes. But the paint was peeling from all the faces, so they looked piebald. Two of these men, wizened and old, and inclined more to the stature of dwarves than of giants, provided the music for the party. But the fiddle was small, as if shrunken, and the other augmented his tambourine with a metal triangle hanging behind his back, at which he kicked up with every step he took. And they were playing with a bravado that might have touched the hearts of Vera Andreevna and Olga Alexandrovna, if they'd known the tune, "Rule Britannia." A few yapping dogs of breeds as various as this human zoo of odd types ran back and forth around, often coming in for a kick from an outlaw's foot. The escaped women, looked askance at these representative examples of the world from which they had been exiled in the House of Correction. As soon as the outlaws and their foreign captives were out of sight, the women returned to their comrades and debated what was to be done. They soon reached a decision. They did not feel they could take on the outlaws, so would leave their captives in the hands of fate, which would make suitable provision. But they could, and would, go down to the wrecked train, even if a rescue party were to arrive and arrest them as escapees and deserters while they tendered what assistance they could to the injured and the dying. Under the stars, the snow shone a nightmarish, glaring, luminous blue, as if the snow itself gave off a kind of corpse light. But though the fires were dying down, still there was light enough for the women to see that, in fact, little was left for them to do. As they approached, the last living elephant gathered its final reserves of strength together to lift a broken cupboard in its trunk and fling it towards the woods, where it scattered a hail of salt cellars, pepper shakers, and vinegar bottles. Then, with a heart-rending bellow that for a moment filled all the great solitude, the elephant fell upon its side, fell not slowly in stages, but in one crashing motion, down upon the melting snow. After that, a dreadful quiet, except for the crackling of the underbrush that burned as if it might not be consumed. Then Olga Alexandrovna stumbled over a body, and thought at first it was a corpse. But when she saw the bottle in its fist, she knew it was still living, though kick and pinch it as she might, it would not budge. The entire train crew, as it turned out, conductors, waiters, cooks, were prone about the wreck, as at the conclusion of a peasant wedding. The warmth of the fires kept them from freezing. These appeared to be the only survivors, and all seemed in perfect health. The women judged it wisest to let them lie, since it was clear they would come to no harm. Olga Alexandrovna, attracted by the bright colours, she'd been starved of colours, picked out a quilt from a snowdrift, a quilt made of knitted squares sewn together, such as children make. "Here's a treasure trove of useful things left in the wilderness, as if by some miracle, especially for us," she said. She was a practical woman. After a heartening meal of bread and sausage they had brought with them, taken in the welcome heat of the forest fire, they set to salvage what equipment they could. First, Olga Alexandrovna found the gilded figure of an old man with a scythe that had evidently snapped off a broken box of springs and small brass wheels. Vera Andreevna tentatively identified the figure of that of Father Time.
"But wherever we go, we'll need no more fathers," she pronounced,
so they threw it away. Following on from this notion, Vera implored her friend to forbear from the use of the patronymic when she addressed her, which Olga promised to do, and asked her friend to do the same as regards herself. Under a mass of broken chandeliers and torn upholstery, Olga next found a shard of mirror, strangely painted with umber stripes on orange. When she touched it, it burned her fingers. She dropped it. It broke into a thousand lesser fragments, leaving, to her horror, a trace of smoking liquid in the snow. A superstitious fear overcame her.
"Let's get out of here," she said to Vera.
"Where shall we go, my darling?"
Under the glazing stars, the railway track ran from its fiery terminus back, back, back the thousand miles to St. Petersburg, to the narrow tenement in which Olga's aged mother crouched before the charcoal under the samovar in the continuous repetition of her daily toil, while the little boy, who no longer remembered her, played outside in the alley at games at which she could no longer guess. Vera kept her eyes down, as she had done before their fingers touched. She knew that to look is to coerce, and whatever else might lie in store for them, at this moment, they were free to choose. Olga, in inner turmoil, sat down on the pile of table linen that had been disclosed when the last elephant cleared the last cupboard. By the shattered remains of tables, vases, bottles, and silverware around them, this must have been the restaurant car. Other women, decisions made, picked over the detritus of the kitchen near at hand, putting on one side all manner of things that would come in useful, saucepans, kettles, cauldrons, knives, all of such large sizes as would suit communal kitchens. They carried out stocks of food, sacks of flour and sugar and beans, although they left behind the gravy browning with which the kitchen was so plentifully stocked. There were even a great many eggs in wire baskets that, on a whim of the explosion, had escaped destruction. Above the clatterings and the exclamations,
"Give strawberry jam! I say, chocolate! Will you believe, my dear, a patent ice bucket?"
Olga's prison-quickened ears now believed they detected a moan, such as a sick or frightened child might make, coming from inside the place where she sat. She leapt to her feet and hurled aside the cloths and napkins. So she uncovered him, a ruddy, flaxen-haired young man in a child's short white trousers, sleeping sound as if between white sheets on a feather bed. His breath did not smell of liquor. There was a contusion on his forehead.
"How shall we wake him?"
"The old tales diagnose a kiss as the cure for sleeping beauties," said Vera, with some irony.
Olga's maternal heart did not heed that irony. She pressed her lips to his forehead, and his eyelids slowly fluttered, slowly opened, and he lifted up his arms and slowly put them round her neck.
"Mama?"
he said, that universal word. Smiling, she shook her head. She saw that Walter no longer knew enough to ask, "Where am I?" Like the landscape, he was a perfect blank. They lifted him to his feet to see if he could walk. After a few tries and demonstrations, he got the hang of it and laughed out loud with delight and pride as he toddled with increasing confidence back and forth from Olga's arms to Vera's less welcoming ones, until he could manage by himself. Shortly after that, he discovered in himself sensation. He rubbed his hand on his belly in a circular motion and searched the absence that had been his memory, but he could find nothing there to tell him what to say, so he kept on rubbing. Olga Alexandrovna found a can of milk in the kitchen, crumbled bread in it, and got him to take some of that from her fingers because he no longer knew how to use a spoon. He was pleased with everything and cooed, gazing round him with eyes the size of saucers. When he finished his bread and milk, he rubbed his belly again to see what might be forthcoming this time. Olga Alexandrovna picked up the wire basket of eggs.
"Does he want a nice eggy then?"
The sight of the eggs set the jumble behind his eyes in motion. All manner of connections took place. Up he rose on tiptoe and flapped his arms.
"Tak-a-doodle-dusky!"
"Poor thing," said Olga Alexandrovna. "Lost his wits. May the good Lord protect him."
Then a shrill whistle pierced the night, and far off they saw the sparks and glowing tender of a railway engine arriving from the direction of the railhead at R, and they made out the shapes of men with torches, lanterns, ropes and axes walking alongside the slowly moving engine. The white apron of a nurse flashed as she leant out of the cabin to catch a glimpse of the work that lay before her. So Olga Alexandrovna's decision was made for her, and all now hastened to gather together bundles of useful tools and utensils and to make off into the woods towards the radiant uncertainties of love and freedom. Olga, in a hurry, stuck a pin into an egg and gave it to Walter to suck, which he did eagerly.
"Cock-a-doodle-doo!"
"I hate to leave the poor thing," she said to Vera.
"He is a man, even if he has lost his wits," replied Vera. "We can do without him."
Still Olga lingered, as if she thought there must be something useful this young man could do for them, if only she could think of it. But time was running out. When she kissed Walser goodbye, she kissed goodbye to her own son and all the past. The women vanished. Walser crouched over the basket of eggs, but found they were easily crushed. Disgruntled, he kicked the basket over and had some fun watching the eggs that remained whole roll around. The rescue party drew nearer, at a stately pace, for however great the emergency, the antique stock would only chuff along at the most geriatric rate. Walser had some more fun jumping on the rolling eggs and smashing them, but not as much fun as all that. Bored, he flapped his arms again.
Cock-a-doodle-doo! Cock-a-doodle-dooski!
When he realized the kind ladies were all gone, tears ran unhindered from his eyes. Crowing like a cock, flapping his arms up and down, he sprinted off among the trees in search of them, but soon forgot his quest and his enchantment at the sight of dappled starlight on the snow. Chapter 5. As soon as we turned our backs on the train, it ceased to exist. We were translated into another world, thrust into the hearts of limbo to which we had no map. They took us further and yet further into the margins of the forest, which, no hasty gulper, swallowed us up at its primeval leisure. It took me a long while to somewhat recover my composure, and by then we were inside it, as securely as Jonah in the belly of the whale, and in almost as profound a darkness, for the close boughs of the evergreens blotted out the sky, except when a lump of the snow with which they were lined fell on our heads like the droppings of a big cold-blooded bird, and then a few scraps of red light from the fire we'd left behind us showed through the gap, bloody in the night-time clouds. Our hosts, of whose intentions I grew moment by moment more apprehensive, appeared through long custom and the most intimate knowledge of the woods to need no light to guide them along the path they had hewn among the close-grown trunks, and they did not speak to us or one another. Now and then I caught a whiff of the ones who dragged me along, and they smell like hell, I must say. Once I come to myself, prone on that jolting litter, I pummeled their backsides until they let me off, and there was our Liz again. So I gave her a kiss on what bit of her anatomy I could get at, which turned out to be her nose.
"Satisfied, now you're on foot," she greeted me, the old witch. "Find this method of progress more appropriate to the scenery, do you?
Now, when I call Liz a witch, you must take it with a pinch of salt, because I am a rational being, and what's more, took in my rationality with her milk, and you could say it's too much rationality has procured her not altogether undeserved reputation. For when she puts two and two together, sometimes she comes up with five, because she thinks quicker than most. How does she reconcile her politics with her hanky-panky? Don't ask me. Ask that family of anarchist bomb-makers of hers. Who put the bomb in the bomb surprise at Jenny's wedding? Work of a moment for our Johnny, for all his weak lungs. And who would ever think to look for dynamitards in an ice cream parlour, amongst those bonny babies to boot? And at this very moment, back home in Battersea, our babies may be asking, "Where's Auntie Liz now? Where's Feathers?" As for Feathers and Liz, why, they can't answer that question themselves. When I think of the babies, I feel on my front for the lucky violets my Violetta gave me last Christmas. And of course, there they aren't. They've dropped off somewhere in Siberia. Hearing me give out a little sob, Liz says under her breath, "There's a broken pinion. Bad enough." She gives me a hand to squeeze. "And I've lost my lucky violets," I add. She drops my hand sharpish. She hates sentiment. "Bugger your lucky violets, wherever they are," she says. "Prepare yourself for the worst, girl. We've lost the bloody clock, haven't we? Burnt to a crisp in the wreck, most likely. First your sword, now my clock. We'll soon lose all track of time, and then what will become of us? Nelson's clock, gone. And that's not all. My handbag, that's gone too." This was a disaster so great, I scarcely dare think of the distress it would cause us. Forward we went, deeper and deeper into an unknown terrain that was at the same time claustrophobic, due to the trees shutting us in, and agoraphobic,
because of the enormous space which the trees filled. He dragged one increasingly weary foot before the other weary foot, all dreary and incomprehensible as a wet Sunday, until we got to a clearing, full of dirty snow with behind a spike stockade, all manner of haphazard dwellings in it, some like wigwams made of skins, some like tents put up by soldiers, and a few sheds of raw split logs, with all the signs of the hastiest construction, cracks stuffed with earth. I could see everything by the light of sputtery torches of pinewood our captors now ignited, and my suspicions there were no women amongst them were amply confirmed. I would not say this discovery gave me more confidence in my hosts. They all crowded round, especially me, stared at only me, and muttered and exclaimed to themselves, but for the princess or mignon, they never spared a glance. It seemed I formed a special item on the menu, although I kept that blanket tight around me, I can tell you. But they treated us quite kindly. They gave us hot tea and ardent spirits and offered us cold roast, I think moose, but I could eat nothing. I was overcome by silly weeping at the sight of food, which Liz said then was the effect of shock, but afterwards assured me that to see me off my feed was the first cause of real concern I'd given her since I was a baby. They showed us even more consideration that night. They forbore to subject us to interrogation or stuff of that order, since we were so distraught and travel-weary, but put us all in a larger shed, where to sleep on was a wood platform with piles of furs, principally bearskins, not too well cured by the smell. They left us, huddled up all together, the poor remains of the Colonel's circus, and he chattering with indignation as apart from the indignities we'd suffered, he'd no great liking for the vodka they had hospitably provided us, craving his lost bourbon like a baby snatched too early from the nipple and forlornly demanding an American consul to be summoned. "Toot sweet," he said. "Toot damn sweet." There was a clang and a bang outside. "The buggers have slid the bolt on us," amidst much disputation in the Russian language, for these men are not the natives of the place. The native woodsmen are low in stature, yellow of skin, sometimes we've seen them at the stations, loading skins from eyepole sleds into the baggage vans, and they wear curious hats of a triangular shape, and chink with ornaments made of tin. But our men are big sturdy fellas, although we're far too far away from farmland for them to come of that peasant stock imported into Siberia centuries ago to till the soil. And I do think they're strangers here as much as we. There was a fire in the lodging and some of the smoke went up through a hole in the roof. The small boy was left with us, whose task was to sit by the fire all night and feed it with sticks, for they did not trust us with the means of combustion. The clan dogs bounced around to see the little fella, thinking they'd have a game with him. But when one black poodle bitch with its red satin bow still in its curls jumped up at him, beseeching friendship, this jolly little chap seized hold of her and broke her neck with one clean snap of his long-fingered hands, which put all the clans in a terrible humour and didn't reassure me as to the good arts of our hosts in the least. And the looks the fireboy gave poor Sybil the pig were exactly those of ragged urchins that hopscotch on the Queenstown Road give Gianni when he calls out, "Icy, ice cream." So I didn't give Sybil much longer in this world, I can tell you, and she is clearly apprehensive herself, and climbs right down inside the colonel's waistcoat and buries her snout in his breast, whimpering occasionally. Nevertheless, I persuaded the fireboy to split a log so Liz could make splints for my broken wing, binding the splints with strips she tore off our underlinen, and then I felt easier. But we couldn't conceal what we were up to from the fireboy, and his eyes went big as cartwheels when he saw what I'd got to show. Gawd, he stared. And would you believe, he crossed himself. The princess woke up at last and broke that lifelong silence of hers with a vengeance, but to no purpose, since she babbled away hysterically and her words made no sense. Even Mignon could not console her, for it was plain to see the princess knew Othello's occupation was gone. She kept her hands stuck out straight in front of her, as if they no longer belonged to her, as if henceforward she would have no use for them as hands. Her poor fingers were stiff as chapel hat pegs already. She made such a hullabaloo, lamenting presumably the passing of her keyboard nerd tigers, that the clowns grew restive and were all forgetting the fireboy to open the door and shove her out in the snow. But Lizzie found a pack of cards in her handbag
and they settled down, resentfully but quietly, while the princess's passion wore itself out until she lay still in Mignon's arms, racked only by exhausted sobs. Liz hugged me and kissed me, and no matter what state she might have been in under her surface calm, she was fast asleep under the stinking bearskins in two shakes. But my nerves were so ravaged by the shocking tragedy we had undergone, I could not close my eyes, although at last the clowns slept, cards and glasses in their hands. The colonel slept. Mignon and the princess both drifted into sleep. The silence of the forest was interrupted only by the howling of the wolves, a sound that chills to the bone by virtue of its distance from humanity, and told me only how lonely I was, and how the night around us contained nothing to assuage the infinite melancholy of these empty spaces. There I lay, my face buried in my arms, and then I heard the softest step on the earthen floor, and then a touch, the smallest, tenderest touch you might imagine on my back. Quickly as I sprang up, I didn't catch him at it, but now the fire boy crouched cross-legged by the hearth again, with in his hand a purple feather. I had no heart to reprimand him. My movement disturbed the colonel. He rolled on his back and soon was snoring away in concert with his pig. Perhaps their duet lullabied me, for slept I must have, although my young man was burned to a crisp, because the next thing I remember is the unbolting of the door. Turns out the leader of the outlaws wants to see me all by myself, and they've come to take me to his hut. They set me at a rough trestle in front of a goodish breakfast of sour milk, black bread and tea. Sleep had refreshed me, and I thought, well, there's life, there's hope. So in spite of my sorrow, I dipped my bread into the buttermilk and got a little something down. Meanwhile, he tugged his moustaches, which depended in two thin plaits from his upper lip to his Adam's apple, and subjected me to a piercing scrutiny from his close-set but not inherently malevolent eyes. I must have cut a farcical figure, guyed up in what remained of that lace tea-gown, which never suited me even when new, bought it from Swan and Edgar's for the joke, minus a petticoat, plus a blanket around me, toga fashion. His manners, however, and all the stately courtesy of the poor. He never asked me once to show me feathers, though you could tell he wanted ever so, but knew it would be rude.
Now, you are in Transbacalia, where the rivers freeze solid to the bottom and trap the fish like flies in amber.
He announced, you know, I have a knack with foreign languages, pick them up like fleas, and though his Russian was not that of Petersburg, I could follow it well enough and pitch in me own threepence too. Charmed, I'm sure, I said,
welcome to the brotherhood of free men.
Brotherhood, is it? I'm not a man nor your brother either.
His fraternal greetings don't go down half so well as his victuals, and I'll give him a sneer, of which he takes no notice, but surges on.
We are neither prisoners nor exiles, nor settlers, madam, though our ranks on occasion have been swelled by all free conditions of men. We exist outside a law that shows us no pity, and we demonstrate by our lives and deeds how the wildlife in the woods can bring liberty, equality, and fraternity to those who pay the price of homelessness, danger, and death. Swords are our only sisters now. Our wives are those rifles with whom faithfully each night we share our mattresses, and jealously never let out of our sight. We go towards our deaths as joyously as we would towards a marriage.
Don't think I'm unsympathetic to the spirit of his peroration, although the letter wants attending to here and there, to my mind. Swords for sisters, rifles for wives, indeed. What kind of intercourse is that? And anyone with any sense would go towards their marriage as if towards a noose rather than the other way around. This fellow mixes his metaphors the way a topper does his drinks, and I dare say gets just as tipsy on them. Furthermore, it seems to me his speech would sound well set to music, scored for brass and timpani, and a male voice chorus wouldn't come amiss at points. Nevertheless, although he's kidnapped us at this moment, I'm more for him than against him.
Only catastrophe, he goes on, can lead a man to this remote territory.
But ain't I living proof that women don't come here of their own accord either?
To cover up my irritation, I ask him for another glass of tea. With this request, he courteously complies, amidst a clank and bang of armaments, for beside the rifle propped against the trestle in easy reach of his hand, he'd a pair of pistols at his belt, and his peasant caftan was crisscrossed by bandoliers. He'd a wide-bladed sword of a somewhat Turkish design to complete the ensemble. It was the outfit of a conspicuously untamed man, well set off by the extraordinary ferocity of his moustaches. If this get-up smacked a bit of the comic opera bandit, it must have been because they copied his get-up, not he theirs. And there was nothing of the wooden prop about his gun, although it looked old enough to have seen service in the Crimea. Each man of us, even including the first fire boy, is here in flight from a law which would extract punishment from us for the vengeance we took upon those minor officials, army officers, landlords, and such like petty tyrants who forcibly dishonored the sisters, wives, and sweethearts of flesh and blood we all once had, who are now left far behind us.
So that's where women come into this libretto. Absent friends. What do you mean, dishonor? I says, hooking with distaste the dead fly out of my tea. But too cold for flies here, as it turns out. It's nothing but a tea leaf to my relief. I'll probe him further on the dishonor question.
Wherein does a woman's honor reside, old chap? In her vagina or in her spirit?
Which pithy quibble wouldn't sound badly set to music either. Nevertheless, it troubled him, although it might have been I spoke a dirty word that momentarily stemmed his flow. He sucked in his moustache braids and chewed them vehemently, unused to having his opinions questioned.
I do think myself, I added, that a girl should shoot her own rapists.
I gave his rifle such a proprietorial glance that, if he'd anything of that nature in the back of his mind, then he'd got another think coming.
It was my words, he said, evidently not wanting to debate the point with me, that blew up the railway track.
Well done, I says ironically. Smart move. Dynamite a circus train. What kind of strategy is that? And then, oh, then, great, innocent, big-hearted, stupid that he was, his eyes spilled over with fat tears, and he cast aside the trestle, knocking over the remains of my scarcely finished breakfast in his enthusiasm, so he could fall on his knees before me and go into his big aria.
Remarkable lady from beyond the mountains and the distant sea. It is well known that the Tsar, the little father of all the Russians, would, if he but knew of it, never permit that honest peasants such as we should be driven from the plough to live like beasts far away from home, outside the law, because we did no more than he himself would do if dishonor threatened the little mother or his precious girls. The last time we robbed the railhead at R, we took away the newspapers to see whether they carried any stories about us, and there we read how you, the famous aerialist, the winged wonder, the Britannic angel, the intimate of the English royal family. Curse the colonel and his publicity stunts! Would pass through Transbaikalia on your way to the great ocean, where you will cross to the land of the dragonfly to hobnob with another emperor. We blew up the track, dear lady, solely in order to take you hostage, so that we can beg with you, plead on my knees, beating my forehead on the ground before you, suiting his actions to his words, to intercede with your mother-in-law-to-be, the Queen of England.
Whatever has the colonel been up to now? What fresh lies has he been spreading? I'll pay him back for this.
To intercede with the great Queen Victoria, the well-beloved babushka who sits on the throne of England, and with her royal bellows keeps alight the charcoal under the bubbling samovar of the empire on which the sun never sets. I beg you, gracious and amazing creature, to intercede with this Queen Empress, to ask her granddaughter's husband, the Tsar. See, it is a family matter, to ask the Tsar to forgive us all, so that we might return free men to our native villages, to take up the plow we left lying in the fields, milk the cows that have long been lowing untended with swollen udders since we were forced to leave, to harvest the corn we left uncut. For the Tsar is the friend of simple truth, and doesn't know the half of what his officials get up to on the side. I could have laughed, if I wasn't near tears myself by that time, at the pitiful simplicity of the man, at his truly appalling greatness of heart, that he believed in his misfortune. There was some higher authority, which was infallible, and must always know and love the truth when it saw it, as in Fidelio by Beethoven, nobility of spirit hand in hand with absence of analysis. That's what's always buggered up the working class. Though I tried to stop the brigand chief, he covered the hem of my tea gown with wet kisses. Wonderful lady, you shall, you must write to her a letter to Queen Victoria, and we will take it to a train, and the train will chug away with it far, very, very far, even far as unto the city of London. And there, one foggy morning, a liveried butler will bear our letter with its invisible cargo of hope and faith of honest men, even unto the Queen Empress as she sits tapping away with a golden egg spoon at a breakfast egg in its golden egg cup, propped up on the pillows in her bed in Buckingham Palace. When she sees your well-known and beloved writing on the envelope, how gladly she'll cry out, "A letter! A letter from my dear almost daughter-in-law!" And then, by now my knees were sopping wet with tears and kisses, and I could bear it no longer. "Oh, my old duck! You shouldn't believe everything you read in the papers. I'm never engaged to the Prince of Wales. Hasn't he got a perfectly good wife of his own already? I'm not even intimate with him, love. And such an intimacy he'd offer the likes of me wouldn't go down well with the widow of Windsor at all, at all. What idle folly is this, that you fancy these great ones care a single jot about the injustice you suffer? Don't the great ones themselves weave the giant web of injustice that circumscribes the globe?" First, he didn't believe me. Then, when my arguments convinced him, he broke out in a furious tempest of rage, grief and despair, well nigh Wagnerian in its intensity, berating the world, the newspapers, the duplicity of princes, and his own gullibility. And I must say, I heartily sympathised with him. But then he took to breaking every single object in his tent, even kicked the trestle and the chairs apart, such was the fury of his disappointment. All the other bandits rushed in but could do nothing to curb his excesses, so I said, "Send for Samson." And good old Samson the strong man got him in half Nelson and hit him over the head, and in the ensuing hush, we adjourned to our hut, which, such is the human heart's capacity for fixing on whatever security offers itself even in the most extreme circumstances, already feels like home. "Bastards," said Liz, when I told her all, and she did not mean the bandits. Even the colonel looked abashed, as well he might, although he would take no responsibility for our plight, muttering it was a case of caveat emptor, and fools should take responsibility for themselves. But what will the brigand chief do with us when he wakes up? Will he vent his rage upon ourselves? No use commandeering his weapons, since all the bandits are armed to the teeth and have their muzzles trained upon us. We're in a pretty pickle, I must say. The princess is pacing up and down, bereft, her useless hands outstretched, looking ghastly as Lady Macbeth in the sleepwalking scene. Mignon, one step behind, to make sure she does no harm to herself. But the clowns have perked up sufficiently to entertain the fireboy with a few simple card tricks. Episode of the poodle either forgotten or forgiven. But I foresee storms ahead when they run out of cigarettes. The colonel, possibly from unacknowledged guilt, now overcomes his resistance to vodka. To such an extent he is soon well away and sings songs of old Kentucky over and over to himself in a high baritone. So all those still willing and able to form a council of war settle down together on that wooden platform, and they are yours truly, Lizzie, and a strong man. I am aware that strange changes are going on in Samson's frontal lobes.
His eyes that used to be so brightly vacant are darkening and growing more introspective hour by hour. And though the time is not yet ripe for him to leap into discourse, I begin to have great hopes of him in that department. Should we all live so long? If he does not partake in our discussion, he follows with a lively comprehension, and, as we are, is torn between genuine compassion for the deceived outlaws and concern as to our own predicament.
"The sun shines bright," warbles the Colonel, "on my old Kentucky home."
Sybil appeared to have given up on him, now he was in his cups, and was nesting down in the bearskins as far away from the fireboy as she could burrow. But we thought we might as well consult the oracle. And Lizzie extracted the letter cards from the Colonel's pocket without him taking a blind bit of notice. But all the advice Sybil will give us is W-A-I-T-A-N-D-S-E-E. While outside, the snow started to come down again, which spurred the fireboy into action, I'm glad to say. Then we heard the unmistakable sounds of the bandits drowning their sorrows, and, comic operetta brigands as they were, they now indulged in a bass baritone chorus of lament, in parts, although as time wears on, the part singing becomes increasingly ragged. And it was sad music fit to make you cut your throat.
"Here we are," opined Liz, lodged up the arsehole of the universe with a bunch of scabby bandits so sunk in false consciousness they thought the Queen of England would shed a tear for them if only she knew their misery. "And your wing is broken so we can't fly away, and our clock is gone for good, and no means of knowing if that last lot of mail got home or not, which seems the least of our problems, whether the comrades in London got hot news of the struggle." When I say that, we fell out. First time in our lives. Hard words passed between us. We withdraw to separate corners of the shed, to sulk and, what with our bad feelings, and the princess moping and mowing, and Mignon carrying on, and the colonel running through the Stephen Foster songbook in ever a more discordant manner, as if vying with the lamentations of the outlaws outdoors as by the water of Babylon they sit down and weep. Add to that the ululations of the walls and the raucous laughter which accompanies the increasingly indecent games in which the clowns engage the fireboy. I'm beginning to think I must have done something wicked in a former life to land in such a mess in this one. And silly superstitious little tremor as it is, childish and whimsical, all the same, the little sword that always armed me, and Father Time who was once on our side. Both these are gone. Quite gone. Besides, I suspect that not only my wing but also my heart has been a little broken. No dinner brought us, because the bandits are too preoccupied with their dirges. But Lizzie, whose doings I keep watch on out of the corner of my eye, begs a knife off the fireboy and starts in on cutting up the bearskins. So I see she's a plan to make us all some good new clothes, of a kind to withstand the weather outside. And I can't help but wonder if she's cooking up some scheme of her own in her wily old head. But I do not care to ask, since we are not on speakers. Then comes a knocking at the door, and a strange new voice, in educated tones, demands, "Anyone at home?" "Folks on the other side," I sings out. "Open up and walk in." Which is how we made the acquaintance of the escaped convict.
Chapter 6. Early morning. The dark blue sky stains the snow dark blue. The moon appears and disappears, teasingly behind a scarf of blue gauze. Everything looks transparent. A volatile figure with its jaw now lightly clad in silvery beard flits through the thickets, evidently impervious to cold, for it exhibits no discomfort, although it is half naked since it has lost its trousers, its comedy suspenders, and its wig. There are feathers of the snowy owl, the golden eye, the raven, stuck in its hair, along with burrs, thorns, twigs, mushrooms, and mosses. This man looks as if both born in and born of the forest. He mistakes the stars for birds and chirrups at them,
as if he knew no other language. Perhaps that angel who keeps the small birds under his wing has, in spite of his size, adopted him. For apart from scratched shins, no harm has befallen him, and the odds and ends of cast-offs knocking about inside the box that used